dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venter Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The material in last week's show, judging by the comments I've received, provoked strong reactions, positive and negative. Let me address the negative, based on what one person wrote to me, because this week's program is likely to be even more provocative for different reasons. Last week, I chose to pair a recent talk by John Doscher with the installment of the reading from Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity because of their similarities. This week, that pairing returns, but because of their differences, specifically the question of how imminent the destruction of our biosphere is. Some of the information that John Doscher presents was not available when Charles published his book 3 years ago. We began reading Chapter 7 last week, in which Eisenstein lays out some ideas of new ways human society could manage its affairs in the age of reunion, specifically money. Eisenstein said that he was optimistic in spite of being fully aware of the myriad problems, and he thinks new approaches won't be adopted until after the catastrophic collapse of the present system. However, the material in John Doscher's talk, Out of Time, given at the Greenfest in Alfred, New York last weekend, discusses the latest scientific concerns of runaway climate change leading to near extinction of the entire biosphere of Earth within this century, obviously precluding any implementation of a better vision of the world. The objection to last week's material seemed basically to be about the spiritual content of both of the presentations, which the listener described as an irrational element that he thought discredited the speakers. Doscher describes himself as a Christian, and he told me he is a member of the Unitarian Church. Eisenstein calls himself an animist and has explicitly written that he sees the Judeo-Christian worldview as fundamentally the same as the non-theistic scientific worldview. The question of rationality is an interesting one to me because I believe there is such a thing as the abuse of reason, or as they say, garbage in, garbage out. It's perfectly possible that a well-reasoned conclusion based on the evidence at hand may turn out to be false or unethical. If your basic premise is that the rise in GDP measures economic growth and that economic growth is good, you might rationally conclude, as prominent economist Dr. Lawrence Summers did, that the nations of Africa are underpolluted and it would be desirable for them to sell themselves on the market as a place to relocate toxic industries and dump toxic waste, which would raise their GDP. This Summers wrote in a letter to a colleague, and when it became public, he claimed he was being sarcastic. You decide. Yes, that is the same Larry Summers who is now an economic advisor to President Obama, a former World Bank economist, and a former president of Harvard University who created a controversy by saying that women were biologically unsuited to excel in science. Let me share with you an interesting, reasonable, and false conclusion from the scientists of medieval Europe. Reason and logic are not modern inventions and date back at least to the ancient Greeks. Scholars and scientists in the medieval world were aware of the tools of reason, while at the same time they believed that miraculous cures could be obtained by touching sacred relics. One of the great questions for medieval doctors, who the church denounced as atheists, by the way, was how exactly human procreation occurred. Originally, the man was thought to have seed, which was planted, so to speak, in the womb of the woman that was seen as a growing medium like soil, either fertile or infertile. However, they realized this couldn't be quite right, as the same woman was sometimes fertile and other times not, even though the seed had been planted. They had no microscopes, and dissections were illegal, so very few of these were done, and those surreptitiously. These doctors, all men of course, came up with a rational new theory. They concluded that since the seed of the man was released through sexual climax, there must also be a seed of the woman, also released during sexual climax. And the reason why intercourse did not always lead to pregnancy was because the woman had not been satisfied to the point of climax. Although they had been breeding livestock for millennia, they did not connect the estrous cycles of animals with humans. They did not know about evolution, and each creature was believed to be a custom design by God, and so there was no reason you should infer anything about human reproduction from the reproduction of horses or dogs. The upshot of this theory about female ejaculation was that women who became pregnant after having been raped were judged to have been consenting participants by reason of the fact that the pregnancy proved that the woman had climaxed and therefore must have been a willing and enthusiastic participant in the event. That is an abuse of reason, and we have analogous abuses today, which one day perhaps, if we survive, will seem as ridiculous as the theories of medieval doctors seem to us today. And that is one of Eisenstein's points. My purpose is not to turn the show into a forum for theological disputation. Whether you believe that Jesus was a son of God born of a virgin, or a mortal born in the usual way, or whether someone of that name actually lived 2,000 years ago or not, I think it is perfectly valid to discuss the ideas attributed to someone called Jesus, just as it is to discuss the ideas of Charles Eisenstein or you or me. And more importantly, to discuss what is the impact of those ideas and beliefs on society. I do not believe in a supreme being, and have not since the age of 7, just because what I was told did not match my experience and I could not believe it. What did match my experience is that the world is sacred and that I am in love with its beauty and its creatures, and that the only ugly places I've ever seen are the ones made ugly by the profit-making activities and insanity of human beings. And this is particularly tragic, as humans are capable of creating things of sublime beauty and need not destroy the world. Consider the Walmart, the Home Depot, the strip mall, and their parking lots. Why are these things so ugly? If one wants to have a store, why should it be ugly? Consider the following famous large buildings: the Parthenon, built for the worship of a goddess; the Taj Mahal, built by a king to commemorate the dead wife he loved; Westminster Abbey, built for the worship of a god; or Hearst Castle, built for a man's worship of his own wealth and power. Each is a completely different style, yet all are beautiful, and they were meant to be. The Walmart was not meant to be, because the people who will profit by inflicting its ugliness on others do not have to look at it. It's no accident that strip malls are not placed amid the estates of the wealthy, which are always very beautiful. The buildings are beautiful, and they are surrounded by gardens and fountains, and often situated amid breathtaking natural scenery. You get the idea. Beauty is a social justice issue. It is my right and your right to live on this beautiful earth, the only Garden of Eden that I know of, and not to be subjected to ugliness, whether physical or social, so others may profit. What is a slum but a horribly ugly place where poor people are forced to live? If it were not ugly, they would not be allowed to live there. They would be thrown out so rich people could move in, and this is exactly what happens in the process of gentrification. Let me give you another piece of evidence. Here where I live, many people do not make the outside of their houses look nice, because if they do, the tax assessor will raise the value and they'll have to pay more money to live there, which they cannot afford. What is this but a system that decrees beauty for the rich and ugliness for the poor? Have you ever seen a parking lot that is not ugly? Why must it be ugly? I could design a parking lot that looked like Kew Gardens, and I bet some of you could too. The reason the parking lot is ugly is because it has been designed to maximize profit by people who are not held accountable for destroying the beauty of the places where others have to live. And so they blow up the mountains of West Virginia where live a bunch of poor people, not to mention other animals and plants. Forget about them. And they want to destroy the Finger Lakes with gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing. If we cared enough not to destroy the home places of others, we would also have not done all of the other horrible things routinely discussed on this program. My privilege as a broadcaster is to present things to you that I think are worthy of being thought about. And your privilege as listeners is to think about them what you will, or of course, not listen to the show at all. Both of these speakers have spent years trying to find solutions to our horrible problems, and they are presenting them with the most sincere desire to benefit all of us. If you object to anything that they are saying, and there's no doubt that there are many things in there that people could object to, I would be delighted to read on air your critiques that also advance different solutions that we could all ponder. John and Charles are, after all, just people like us. So now, here's John Doscher speaking on August 8th, 2009, in Alfred, New York, at the New York Green Fest.
I'm likely to get you very depressed today as I go through all this. But please, hang on to the moment, because I don't believe in giving up, and I don't believe that it's entirely hopeless. I just think that we're going to have to start running awfully, awfully fast. And so I'll try the social ways in which we might be able to run awfully fast. And of course, they will sound kind of crazy, because by the time you're running that fast, you're kind of crazy. And that's just the way it is. The title of this talk is Out of Time. In 1998, the World Watch Institute published some findings. On the basis of per acre counts of species diversity around the world, it had been concluded that 52% of remaining species existed in the Amazon rainforest. The Red Books on Extinctions concluded that, and if I remember this correctly, it's either 12 to 14% of all species were already extinct, and that at least 34% were endangered. World Watch then studied the rate of destruction of the Amazon forest from space, and it discovered astonishing differentials between on-the-ground reports and what they were seeing from space. What they were seeing was that at the rates then found, the Amazon forest will be gone by 2018, turned into desert. Since then, if anything, the reports indicate a continued acceleration of the rate of destruction. Moreover, Sumatra, until recently 100% forested, is due to be burnt and cut clear this year, Frantic conservation efforts may have saved a little. Borneo, its much larger neighbor, is going the same way. These were two of the world's premier reserves of biological diversity. I tried to parse it all out using a simple impact formula. The answer I've gotten is that by 2034 through 2038, for all practical purposes, we will have reached the 100% extinction level. That is, we'll have utterly destroyed our biosphere. What will remain will be isolated specimens, some generalist species, weeds, pests, diseases, vast monocultures of crops, and vast monocultures of trees, all such monocultures being extremely susceptible to disease. The biosphere has certain Dyson properties. It acts as a living system to maintain climatic stability, to maintain levels of oxygen, nitrogen, water vapor, and carbon dioxide at optimum levels. The basic structure of the biosphere is the natural community. A natural community is a group of species that have lived together in one place for a very long time, co-evolving over that long period to develop myriad symbioses, that is, cooperative ways of living. These support the survival and development of the Earth's life system. All organisms are part of the biosphere. Sometimes an organism gets into a distant system in which it didn't evolve. About 3,000 do that every day now. Courtesy of free trade and the human species' tendency to run all over the place. Many of these exotic species don't fit with the new communities they find themselves in. Some die. Others, however, become pests, destroying entire ecosystems. An ecosystem is a natural community plus its natural habitat. Today, all ecosystems appear to be collapsing, or nearly all. One might think that we could survive if there are plenty of green plants, even if they no longer exist in communities. But it doesn't work that way. Here's an example. In 2008, about April 23rd, on WSKG-TV, there was a National Geographic special, Strange Doings on Planet Earth. European fishing fleets had destroyed the fishery off Southwest Africa. They left. The fish began to return, but too slowly. The plankton, which normally, most of them by far, have their life cycles on or near the surface, weren't eaten. They died, sank to the bottom in unaccustomed tonnages, and rotted, producing huge amounts of hydrogen sulfide and methane. These were locked into the ooze by pressure. But when a low-pressure weather system went overhead, they were released in New Jersey-sized explosions. The hydrogen sulfide killed all the fish. The methane went into the atmosphere, where it stays for about a decade. Methane, molecule for molecule, is 103 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. I have to change tenses now because that process is still going on. Indeed, there seems to be no way to stop it. Then, a few weeks later, there was a news item on NPR that there are presently 200 such zones around the world, and I wish that somebody would check that out. Can we live with extinctions? With mass extinction? Can we live on a planet whose temperature has been raised 25 degrees by huge releases of methane? No, we cannot. Such a release occurred 55 million years ago. It raised the Earth's temperature 25 degrees, extinguishing at least 95% of all species. Had there been humans, they would have been extinguished very quickly. Taking care of the ecology matters. If we don't figure out a way to stop that methane release process off Southwest Africa and all those other places, very soon, we're gone. Well, couldn't we wait it out in underground cities? The answer is that it took the Earth 10 million years to evolve a new biosphere that worked. Could those facilities last 10 million years? To put that in perspective, the Yucca Mountain facility was recently closed by a judge who found that although its mandate was for it to be secure for 300,000 years, it was good for only 10,000. In 10 million years, such underground cities could be under 3 miles of water, or at the North Pole. 10 million years is an extremely long time. About April 18th of 2006, again on WSKG-TV, there was a special called Dimming the Sun. A group of scientists used a 3-day grounding of all aircraft after the Twin Towers incident to test the pan evaporation rates in the U.S. They found a 3% difference and concluded that contrails had for a long have been cutting out 3% of the sunlight. Moreover, other scientists had found out that overall at least 16% of all sunlight was being cut out by particulate matter in the air. Their conclusion from that and other findings was that global warming forces are much more powerful than had been believed, and that as the US, Europe, China, and India are forced to clean up the air because of all the health and environmental problems caused by that particulate matter, those forces will be released, and that global warming will be accelerated uncontrollably, unless we end all greenhouse emissions worldwide by 2016. That's only 6 years away. If, they say, such emissions aren't ended by then, global warming will be out of control. The Earth's temperature will rise 18.2 degrees by 2070, extinguishing humanity. Here's other bad news. Kyoto had given methane a weighted value versus carbon dioxide of 8 times carbon dioxide's strength as a greenhouse gas. That had to do with the amount of time each stays in the air and how much is in the air. That weighting has since been raised to 25 times. But if a great deal of methane is released at one time, its operative strength could rise to its true value of 103 times. At the very least, Kyoto made a threefold error of underestimation. Then, about 2003 or 2004, the Scientific American, in a small sidebar, stated that it had been found that the level of methane in the air is now 4 times its average level for the last 400,000 years. Was that included in the revised weighting? I don't know. As the Earth has warmed, the sea ice around the poles has melted. About 1/3 of it is now gone, and I just heard that more than that is gone, but I'll leave it there. Sea ice reflects about 84% of the sun's rays, absorbing only 16%, which is turned into heat. By the newly exposed waters as the ice melts, but the newly exposed waters as the ice melts reflect only 16% of the sun's rays and absorb about 84%. That is, wherever the sea ice has melted, the heating rate of the water has increased fivefold. Some years ago, World Watch predicted that all marine fish will be extinct by 2033. I haven't seen a correction, if that is a reasonably accurate estimate. Then, taking the Southwest Africa event into consideration, we can expect the entire world ocean to have been converted by about then into a gigantic machine for the production and release of hydrogen sulfide and methane. That would seem to me to be a logical conclusion. There can be only one outcome from such a runaway process: human extinction, possibly as early as 2033, or even sooner. As the Earth has warmed, the tropics have expanded in each hemisphere, 2 degrees farther from the equator, causing great climatic change. For example, Australia's 11-year drought has now been labeled as permanent. That is, as a permanent change to desert. The 32-degree Fahrenheit isotherm, that's called the melting isotherm, has also moved much closer to the North Pole, there not being much land in the southern hemisphere at that latitude. As the world warms, the tundras, which cover probably more than 1 million square miles, have warmed. Now, that includes parts of Sweden, across European Russia, across Siberia, across parts of Asia, across Alaska, and across Canada. They contain stupendous amounts of carbon dioxide and of methane. They go down to depths of as much as 1,000 feet. The warmer they get, the more of those gases is released into the air. The more is released, the warmer it gets. But that's not all. There's a complication. So long as the tundras stayed at or below 32 degrees, they didn't melt. But the isotherm has moved much farther north. The melting of the tundras has created ponds and lakes all across Siberia, northern Russia, Alaska, and Canada, and I should have added Sweden. While they were dry, the vegetable matter that makes up those surfaces slowly oxidized, releasing its carbon in the form of carbon dioxide. But under the water, the vegetable matter is deprived of oxygen. So as it warms, it decays anaerobically, releasing its carbon in the form of methane. So as the melting point isotherm has moved north, the tundras melt, crumble into the lakes, and release methane, which, molecule for molecule, is 103 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. The release of methane from those melting bogs has increased exponentially, that is, explosively. Were that carbon released as carbon dioxide, it could raise the Earth's temperature 5 degrees Fahrenheit. But the same carbon released as methane could raise the Earth's temperature by tens of degrees, that is, by 20 degrees or more. As the atmosphere warms and as droughts become more common and more pronounced, fields and forests change from being a carbon sink to a carbon source. That would be a tipping point that would more than double the emission rate of carbon into the air. By 2040, it's estimated, that balance will tip. By the end of the century, the biosphere could be adding as much as 8 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air each year, enough to raise global temperatures an extra 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit, a prediction not yet included in IPCC forecasts. IPCC equals International Panel on Climate Change. Another prediction is that at today's rate of emission of carbon dioxide from its territory, Great Britain will be a desert within a century. Another discovery is that as the troposphere warms, there is a connection to the stratosphere such that the warmer the troposphere gets, the faster the prevailing westerly winds blow around the polar regions, transferring heat to those regions faster and faster. Most of Antarctica seems relatively unaffected to its pyramidal topography. However, the Western Peninsula is melting rapidly. In the North Polar region, the effect is drastic. Greenland now releases enough meltwater to cover Texas in 2 feet of water each year, and increasing. The winds blow over the tundras. Well, you can see now where that will lead. Rajendra Pachauri, head of the IPCC, says that it will be too late by 2012 if we haven't by then made a fundamental change in our energy systems worldwide. I don't know what he means by fundamental. He means a complete. Well, okay. The Earth's climate systems are now so destabilized that there are now serious doubts, very serious doubts, as to whether anything is any more reversible. We seem clearly to have entered into several positive feedbacks that feed on themselves, increasing explosively. These tipping points are linked. Each feeds the others. The tip has begun. That is, the dynamic into a great and very rapid change has definitely begun. The glaciers in the Andes will be gone by 2024. Those in the Himalayas will be gone by 2039. Billions of people depend on the seasonal melt from them for agriculture. That includes India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and China, which is already desertifying rapidly, very rapidly, in its northwest. India, China, and the U.S. are running out of water. In the U.S., for example, the Ogallala and Edwards aquifers have been sinking out of sight for years. A process of desertification has already begun throughout the entire breadbasket region from South Dakota down through Texas and from Wyoming and Colorado east to at least Missouri. Southern California and several other western states are desertifying. Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi are just coming out of a severe multi-year drought. WorldWatch predicted some years ago that China alone will have to import more food than the entire world can export by 2025, since revised to 2030. It now looks more like 2025 after all. Now that the Antarctic continent has lost two of its ice shells out into the sea, the rivers of ice that flow to the sea from the ice cap, unrestrained by the now absent ice shells, flow to the sea 9 times faster than before. This year, we've seen a cooling in New York, in my opinion, in June and July overall. It could be in other places as well. Why? There could be a change in the Gulf Stream since its resupply flow has all but stopped, leaving a lot of cold, fresh water on the surface. However, something else has been going on also. It's called chemtrails. Real contrails evaporate almost as soon as they're laid down. These instead expand and coalesce to form cloud cover. I began complaining about the weird clouds about 5 or 6 years ago. Finally, someone said, oh, I know, you're talking about chemtrails. It's on the internet. I don't have a computer, but another friend got me a printout. It seems that the U.S. government has been putting some kind of particulate matter into the air from planes for years, both here and in Europe, perhaps elsewhere as well, to create daytime clouds that block out the sunlight. It seems everyone knows, but no one says anything. The fake contrails don't evaporate as real ones do. Instead, while they're turned on, they spread out to become clouds and then overcasts. Sometimes they turn them on, then off, then on, simulating trains of clouds. I can often see the central tracks through the clouds, sometimes a dozen or so, all parallel. My guesstimate is that throughout late June and July, so far, at least 30% of sunlight has been blocked out and reflected back into space. And on some days, I think it would have been more like 80%. We've been told by high-ups for years that there's no such thing as global warming. High-ups with close ties to oil and coal interests. Just one more big lie, it seems. Obviously, better we should all die so that oil, gas, and coal interests can continue to have their profit party. This is just another technical fix. Well, so were pesticides, herbicides, and nuclear power, and genetically modified crops. So was Yucca Mountain, which was closed down by a judge recently, as I just said before. So temporary storage facilities will continue to overflow, and the radioactive plume heading for the Columbia River will finally be allowed to destroy the river, while new licenses and contracts are also let for new nuclear plants for the first time in decades. We're told, too, that in the Earth's past, global warming happened before carbon dioxide levels went up. Therefore, they say carbon dioxide doesn't raise temperatures. Carbon dioxide is indeed a greenhouse gas that's measurable in a laboratory. However, we've learned that tremendous releases of methane can also occur, and that it's a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. What are the oxidation products of methane, water, and carbon dioxide? We don't know everything. However, we've learned that tremendous releases of methane can also occur, and that it's a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. What are the oxidation products of methane, water, and carbon dioxide? We don't know everything, but we now know enough so that almost all scientists recognize global warming as a very serious, a critical problem threatening our survival. Another source of global warming may be undersea volcanism. It's not known as to just how much there's been. Sudden outflows of very cold fresh water from a huge glacial lake in Canada suddenly cooled the climate. When the outflow stopped and the fresh water was gone, the Gulf Stream started again with a sudden warming. We've seen that tundras in the seas can suddenly produce huge amounts of methane, producing warm spells. Right now, said the scientists who produced Dimming the Sun, there are 10 trillion tons of methane in shallow seabeds that could be released at any moment, quote, end quote. They contain more energy than all of the Earth's carbon-based fuels. Were they released, they'd warm the Earth by at least 25 degrees, almost instantaneously extinguishing humanity. Others have since assured that those deposits go down 276 feet below the surface of the ooze, and that even a real warming of the surface of the seabed couldn't release much. However, if the seabeds, I say, were warmed from beneath by volcanism, they could be released. That's the kind of planet we live on. It pays to walk carefully. Ruminants, such as cattle, sheep, bison, and goats, emit tremendous amounts of methane as part of the digestive process. Their contribution to global warming is significant. Global warming is real. Its major causes are variations in solar radiation, volcanism, emissions of carbon dioxide and methane, positive feedbacks, the raising of ever more ruminants, industrial chemicals, and so on. In this morning's presentation, I explained how our government has long been illegitimate, serving a corporate sovereign which in turn serves and is owned by a predatory elite. I also reported how we came to have a permanent, conscious, deliberate plan to have a global empire and to achieve permanent military supremacy. Both of these are examples of elite consensus, the first becoming law through the back door, the second becoming the required elite culture to which you can't really belong unless you accept it. A culture that has guided all subsequent legislation and international policy and domestic policy as well. The U.S. is essentially bankrupt and deliberately impoverishing its own workers. While enriching the already rich and reducing taxes on the rich, our government has destroyed its own tax base. It has also pursued a very expensive imperial agenda while refusing, since 1979, to do anything at all about the combined crises of oil dependency and global warming. It has let our international debt rise to about $6.6 trillion while increasing our national debt to over $12.5 trillion as against a GDP of about $14 trillion. Credit card debt is about $52 trillion. Derivatives, so many of them U.S. sourced, exceed the world's GDP. In patenting life, it has permitted the ongoing closure of the biospheric commons, killing many third world farmers and endangering all life systems in order to gain exclusive, privatized control over all living things, most especially people. Every one of these policies has pushed the world into greater instability, ecologically and socially. They have pushed the U.S. itself into a position in which it soon may no longer be able to afford to import oil or to dominate far places. If the U.S. economy collapsed, how many soldiers would we abandon abroad? If the dollar falls precipitately but doesn't fold, our access to oil will end. Should that happen, and I consider the odds to be at least 50-50, there will be, no doubt about it, mass starvation in the U.S. and the deaths of tens of millions of people, if not more. Our agriculture and transport are both 100% dependent on oil, 72% of which we import. The question that we have to face now is this: what can be done? I'll restate that. What must be done? I list priorities and priority solutions. If they ever get done, it will have to be done by us, the people, however we can. That's what it comes down to. Now, some of them that I will give will be like in the political sphere and so on. But if you don't clear those away, you're not going to be able to get to the others. So here we go. One, close all marine fisheries. Restock them with fish using special ships that can transport them alive. Net excess plankton. Use them to generate methane to be immediately burned in combined cycle cogenerative power plants, which can be up to 94% efficient. And reduce carbon emissions tremendously for an interim period until that problem of the fisheries is solved and until a shift has been made to solar and wind. Two, cover the bogs in the tundras and the northern polar seas with a highly reflective white surface. It could be something like chemtrails supplemented by structures with reflective panels held up by stanchions, the panels spring-loaded, so that if snow piles up on them, they dump it and resume their position. That does, of course, sound insane. It is. It's an insanity created by insane people. What else can we do? We could just decide to die and let it go at that. Something like chemtrails might work in the southern polar seas. There aren't any tundras there. Three, prohibit all births. In the demographically younger, very heavily populated countries, put the prohibition into effect for 20 years. Then go on a very strict one-child policy with a death penalty for breaking the law. Basis, treason. In the demographically older developed countries, the reproductive clause could last 15 years, after which there could be a strict one-child policy until the population is down to 14% of today's. In the other countries, require the populations to go down to 7% of today's. The reduction in 15 years would be, very roughly, about 892,500,000 people. In 20 years, in excess of 1.1 billion. We'd still have a long way to go to get down to 500 million, which is about all that we could be sure that the Earth could support sustainably at this time, given the tremendous damages. If, meanwhile, we upgrade all technologies while aiming production levels at the 500 million level, living standards could be much improved overall, while demand for energy, food, and trees would steeply decline, and greenhouse emissions much reduced as conversion rates to sustainable energy sources and technologies are multiplied. Ruminants should be eliminated as sources of food, including milk and cheese, because of their tremendous methane emissions and because their production requires tremendously more in the way of water and land than does production of grains. Eventually, we could increase our population worldwide to perhaps 2 billion. I doubt if that okay could arrive in less than 90 years. It will more than likely take centuries to repair the damages and to recreate a properly functioning biosphere. Four, create jobs to breed appropriate fish and other marine species at maximum speed to put them into disaster areas such as that of Southwest Africa. Also, in the temperate and tropical zones, restore diverse forests at forced pace so that there are at least 5 acres of nature preserve for each person and many more acres for lumber and other uses. Restore estuaries. Destroy all large dams. Restore coastal wetlands, which are prime breeding grounds, along with estuaries for many marine species. In order to do this, millions of acres of soybean farms will have to be restored to forests. Millions, hundreds of millions, of people will have to be removed from coastal lands, towns, and cities in order to make room for the restoration of diverse forests, wetlands, grasslands, and savannas. Planting about 326.73 billion trees will take about 3 million square miles. That's about the size of the contiguous United States. Replacing imposed monocultures and destroyed forests alone. These efforts would take up large parts of, for example, Honduras and Haiti, now treeless or nearly so, and like areas, Sumatra, Borneo, India, Pakistan, China, Japan, South America, the U.S., and Canada, Europe, European, and Siberian Russia. In order to restore those lands, it would take the complete removal of about 4 billion people, many from places with over 700 people per square mile. Even with radical improvements in technologies, that number could not be reduced, in my opinion. It took over 300 years to create the present mess. It will not be cleaned up in just a few decades. It would be a miracle if we could even come close within a century. And if the thing's now as much out of hand as I think it is, fixing it in 1,000 years would be a miracle. 5, ration gasoline, natural gas, and heating oil. Place a tax on oil to bring its price up to $75 per barrel. When the price passes that limit, use the money collected to make up the difference. That price is one that will be very supportive of rapid conversion to solar and wind without shutting down the economy. 6, bring the growth rate of solar and wind energy systems up to 211.5% per year. Basically, what you're doing is tripling each year the amount, the growth, the total amount, excuse me. Support the costs with taxes on trade. Also, use credits, spendable only in the country of origin, to other countries for the development of those systems at that speed. What can governments do to restructure their economies to operate more sanely and effectively to get this all done? 1, put an end to free trade and to foreign direct investment in all its forms everywhere immediately. 2, eliminate corporate personhood immediately. Replace corporations with contractual entities with no rights as persons, in which all management personnel and the entire resources of the entity are held entirely responsible and accountable for all liabilities and criminal acts. Make such entities owned and chartered by from 1 to 6 small cities that are together a cultural and industrial regional entity based on participatory democratic forms of government observing heptarchic, not hierarchic, principles. Heptarchy is a good idea of Kirkpatrick Sales, who has written several books. 3, require each city to be net self-sufficient in renewables within as close to 5 years as possible. That will require the movement of many people out of large cities. Each city must trade in these things. Non-fish food, fish, fiber, timber, and other forest products, water, energy, and seeds. Only for variety, not supply, and only within categories. For example, fish only for fish, seeds only for seeds. This will close some important negative feedback loops, markedly improving sustainability. 4, adopt a policy of mandated balanced trade for the country and for each city, requiring exports to pay for imports on a 3 months forward orders basis with priorities for critical raw materials imports. 5, terminate the 100 orders imposed on Iraq's constitution by Paul Bremer, the orders that convert Iraq into a U.S. national corporate colony. And if we want people to stop hating us, maybe we should treat them in ways that are not hateful. 6, so that it never be used by anyone, blow up the so-called embassy in Iraq, which is really an armed imperial outpost designed to be powerful enough to control Iraq's government. Put in a real embassy of one small building, not 21, with enough soldiers to protect the gates, no more, and certainly not costing $750 billion, as this one has. 7, order all U.S. forces out of Iraq in 10 weeks. 8, offer Iraq reparations of $780 billion and credits spendable only in the U.S. to shift over to solar and wind. 9, abandon the plans to run pipelines from the Caspian Basin region across Afghanistan to Asia and across Iran, Turkey, and Kosovo to Europe. 10, connect with the Taliban in Afghanistan, the Taliban which we largely created under Reagan, and develop a treaty that puts an end to al-Qaeda and to other forms of militancy in return for U.S. support of the regime so long as it is peaceful. And I wouldn't expect al-Qaeda to be ended immediately that way, but when you have the people behind you, it certainly helps. 11, offer Pakistan large credits for conversion to solar and wind and for internal development and education. Insist that there must be economic and social progress. because that country is ready to explode. For a do-it-yourself people's initiative, I do, of course, suggest the efficacy of civil disobedience in order to achieve the many necessary changes. I also suggest that people unite to localize the production of farm and forest products just as fast as possible, and to develop as many other local industries as possible, just as fast as possible. The U.S. is not very likely to remain solvent too much longer. Changing to balanced trade and ending all foreign ownerships as a global policy for all could preserve solvency and get the U.S.'s people back to work for a livable wage, and also get the world pointed in the right direction. Place a 100% tax on all individual income over, and catch this one, $77,900. Set the minimum income for any adult at $74,100. Now that would be a rational distribution. Place a 100% tax on the part of any inheritance over $1 million. Require all profits to be reinvested in increasing or upgrading the production of the good that brought them in. With enough energy behind those shifts in policy, much could be done in a very short time. President Obama is obviously just not going to do the job. He's shown every sign of going along with the imperial plan and of continuing to use torture abroad for renditions people who could be anyone who can just be made to disappear. The odd thing is that if the U.S. undertook all the policy changes I've suggested, it would soon have so many friends that it would have fully regained world leadership, and we would all be moving toward a new and far more productive world with a far more workable set of values. The Keynesian policies I've suggested could work well only under policies of mandated balanced trade and of prohibition of all foreign ownerships. With them in force, we could tax all international transactions and flows and get all of the countries to do the same. I'd suggest an initial level of 3%, which, since it would be taken at both ends, would sum to 6%. That would allow very exact bookkeeping to be able to make sure everyone's honest. Let the poor countries keep it all. Let the middle countries keep 2/3. Let the rich countries keep 1/3. The funds not kept would be given to a World Grants Agency, a new one, administered by the General Assembly. The grants would go to countries in proportion to the extent to which their per-person income lags behind the world average. They'd be used as follows: to pay off existing international debts, incurring no more, the tax itself being collected as a basket of currencies from nations or practicing balanced trade and keeping their per-person currency issue stable according to a general agreement. To invest in import-substituting industries, most especially solar, wind, geothermal, and wave power. To restore nature and to restore nature's balance to correct the imbalances I've referred to. To reduce population and to provide family services. Additionally, the developed nations could provide free credits to other nations. Credits spendable only in the countries of origin for solar, wind, and other sustainable power technologies, and also to their own domestic economies to support the necessary responsive development. These should be designed to be spent in 6 years so that by 2016 the entire world will have eliminated all greenhouse emissions. Unfortunately, that would have to come also from industry, which uses other kinds of chemicals, and it's not just a matter then of energy. Competent applications of these credits will create many millions of jobs worldwide, perhaps even billions. The demand for raw materials may push the global economy into inflation. However, the raw materials needed do exist in plenty. Some of the special materials needed for solar panels may have become scarce. In that case, we could easily shift to solar thermal panels and or central collectors from a field of reflectors. In the latter case, where sodium used as a circulating fluid, temperatures could be brought high enough to bring plant efficiency up to 40 to 50%, not the usual 33. Where Spectral Labs' 40.7% efficient panel used, it could cost $3 per watt installed, only a fraction of the cost of today's collectors. They're not doing it right now because they're still working on higher efficiencies. Spectral Lab is trying for still higher efficiencies, but it would be nice if someone tried to get a license to produce these. I think they're worth it right now. The standard cure for the kind of inflation that such a powerful program could induce is to tax away the excessive stimulus while doing everything to make sure that all profits are reinvested. That is, to make sure that producers aren't playing the supply side game and refusing to invest when they can't have profits for themselves. One result of the suggested depopulation program, incidentally, would be deflation, as the number of consumers is reduced. However, by increasing majority incomes as a result of worldly investment, that could be overcome, and of course by better distribution. That could be helped also by much reducing the level of borrowing, the less the better. Bankers wouldn't like it. However, my opinion now is that communities should take over the function of investment banking, and that savings banks should be converted to at-cost utilities owned and managed by the cities they're in, and that the rules should specify most clearly that no loan of any kind is to be treated as a negotiable property, that is, that it cannot be sold to someone else, requiring the original lender to service it to the end. In some interim applications, existing power plants could be adapted and upgraded to combined cycle cogenerator systems, saving money and boosting efficiencies to as high as close to 94%. The development of hydrogen fuel cells should be a very high priority. Present such cells, I believe, have topped out at 37% efficiency, a disappointment relative to the potential, but still 2.46 times as efficient as the standard internal combustion engine. But they're really useless unless the hydrogen is produced using solar or wind power, not coal. People will surely question how retirees could be supported with a population reduction program such as I suggest. The answer is that if the per capita income, if the per person income level is adequate, and if the income is evenly distributed, it will do. It's quite amazing what can be done if we put selfishness, greed, and power lust away. Some would also question the need for a population reduction program in the first place. The expectation is that people are going to want to live at the highest possible standard. That could indeed be a lot more sensible than today's profligacy. However, we are just now way over the line with respect to sustainability. And as a greater part of the world, for example, India and China, moves to fully industrialize and to adopt the American societal pattern, it is clear that we'll very soon need at least six Earths to meet the demands. An impossible equation. A steep population reduction program, as I suggested earlier, could reduce demand for energy and for other things, for example, pesticides and plastics, fertilizers, land and water, and various manufacturers, just as we enter a period of serious energy scarcity, which must worsen over time for some years, possibly leading to starvation on the one hand and to runaway global warming on the other. I've got about two more pages to go. If the scientific knew, continues to worsen, news, if the scientific news continues to worsen, or should the dollar collapse, we may be forced to shut down all greenhouse emission producing activities. We'd be out of fuel for tractors and trucks. Therefore, one of the highest priorities, aside from shifting to solar and wind worldwide by 2016, is to develop tractors and trucks powered by hydrogen one way or the other. If we've got hydrogen-powered tractors, we can still have local polycultural farms that are much more productive overall than our one-crop corporate farms, socially far more constructive, and much more ecologically sound, and survive. I haven't tried to say just what exact kind of social, political, and economic joint system we might have. It's hard for me to think of anything other than a market system, but, good God, not a capitalist market system. Also, not one full of hierarchies, and not one that doesn't give a primary value to the biosphere and to the local ecosystem or set of ecosystems. There is a problem with even non-capitalist market systems, however, and that is the use of money and price as arbiters of production, cooperation, and distribution. Well, we've seen where the commodification of things leads, to complete self-destruction. If we're going to use price, then we're going to have to do that within a larger and more comprehensive and life-affirming set of values. And we're going to have to value each person and each species as much as any other, both for systemic operational reasons and for existential reasons. That's extremely tricky. My best advice is to keep real communities down to 350 people, and cities down to 35,000, and nations down to about 8 or 12 million. Leopold Kohr, K-O-H-R, had a lot to say about all that. He wrote 3 books. If you can get hold of his books, read them all. Use participatory democratic forms of governments and practice heterarchical relations, not hierarchical relations, between and among different governing bodies, one being more encompassing than the other. It may be necessary to pay one person a bit more for being more productive than another for the sake of efficiency. But generally, those differences seldom exceed 2%. Nor can anyone find any valid reason to value any one kind of work more or less than another. Nor can we exclude any kind of work from being made subject to technological unemployment or modification. For example, the work of executives and of doctors can be programmed a computer during your work for a few bucks a day rather than for hundreds of millions per year. We have to remember, too, that investment is a production function, not a form of gambling, and that the prime source of capital is always the people, both as taxpayers and as customers. Moreover, there's no reason why banks shouldn't be government-run utilities that operate at cost. Also, we can easily divide income into disposable income and discretionary income. Discretionary income is what you've got left after you've paid all the bills for necessities. An awful lot of people have none. We can easily divide goods and services into several categories: necessities, amenities, and luxuries. Food, clothing, shelter, education, healthcare, and transport are all necessities. Everyone should be equal in their income of necessities. These can be produced and distributed by profit reinvesting companies that serve communities by contract, preferably locally based businesses. If people have money left over for amenities and luxuries, that can vary, but little. Otherwise, that income will be used to purchase access to illegitimate levels of wealth and power. Another rule should be, of course, that no business may own part or all of any other business, nor may it serve more than one product market, although these need to be defined with care. This may not all satisfy purist socialists, especially state socialists, of whom I'm suspicious. However, it does bring everyone into the system as essentially everyone's equal, and that's exactly what we really need. It leaves plenty of room for mom-and-pop businesses and for reasonably sized companies contracted to communities. It leaves plenty of room for participation rather than domination forms of governance. That, too, is exactly what we need. We have found over and over again that what has brought us to this crisis of survival is greed, power lust, hierarchy, materialism, and the adoption or imposition of criminal ethics and of imposed inequalities. If people understand that, they can also see that the road to survival must really also be the road to justice and spirituality. There's an absolutely tremendous possible future out there for everyone. We have to focus on realizing the shared potentialities we can develop together to the best common ends. There is simply nothing else that can be long-term successful. Thank you. Okay. Yes?
There is still 10 minutes left for questions.
Thank you.
Yes, a comment and a question. To the extent that an executive or a doctor can be replaced by a computer, is exactly what is wrong with both of those as they're practiced today. So I'm not interested in replacing executives or doctors with computers. I'm interested in anyone who's executing anything or healing anyone behaving in such a way as they could not be replaced by a computer. Now my question, have you considered eliminating money entirely?
Yes, and I've also considered an answer to your complaint there, which I tend to agree with, that we really need to change our modes of production. And by localizing, we can do a great deal of that. We don't really need to be producing huge battle weapons, which takes these huge factories. We don't need to be producing millions and millions of cars a year in just one country. We don't really need to run all over the earth. We can have everything that we need right here. We can trade for what we need. And we can move around if we wish in a reasonable way. And we can certainly communicate across the world. But we don't have to have what we have, this kind of industry. As for eliminating money entirely, well, there are very serious problems with money, as I said, with pricing.